Blog Talk Radio.
Gentlemen, let's get ready to be inspired! Introducing in the red corner, American Tennis! And introducing in the blue corner, your host for American Tennis, Mr. Chuck Griese! Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to get in the game.
And good morning and welcome once again. This is Coach Chuck Griese and it's American Tennis. Every week, Wednesday, we will be having American Tennis programs. But I wanted to remind you also, John Denise has a great program. I guess he's in his sixth or seventh year by now. Down in Florida. And he has the different mentorship programs also, Coach Randy Blumendahl's program also. We have more to come. There's a lot of good stuff coming along. But, folks, the purpose of the program has always been for you to stand up, speak out, say those things you need to say, for us to do that, and we try to bring you great guests every week. I'm hoping next week I will have Dr. Jim Poole, and we're going to have a great program on ADD and the assets. Listen now what I'm saying, the assets of ADD, and actually that it's a great benefit. I don't think you've heard that one before, probably, that ADD is actually an asset. I need to ask our sports psychologist today about that. And folks, I have got to go to commercial. I will be right back with you here in just a second here. And this is Coach Chuck Griese, and I wanted to tell you before we even get started about the book that is still out there, Coaching Tennis. And folks, it is now 20 years old, but we're still selling copies all around the world. It's Coaching Tennis by Coach Chuck Griese, and all you need to do is go to Amazon and put down your credit card and whatever you need to do on Amazon these days. You can order this book. We've got over 40,000 copies out there worldwide, and we want you to have a copy too. It's Coaching Tennis by Coach Chuck Griese. That's me. That's one of my four books. You can also go to chuckgriese.net and get information as well. We'll look forward to having you on soon. We'll be right back. Those commercials, sort of ad-libbing them, and I'm glad we've got our guest on here right now. But anyhow, folks, I am proud of that book, my Coaching Tennis book, and our guest today, when we get him on here, will be able to tell you, and it's absolute truth that my first book I hand wrote in 1988 is back before computers. We had to do it the old-fashioned way. We had to sit down and handwrite, and then I hired a secretary to type it all up, and then I had to get an English professor to do all of the editing, and then I had to take pictures, and it was about a 10-year process. But anyhow, the book Total Tennis Training came out in 88, and then in 97, Coaching Tennis came out, and I do want you to go out there and see it. And you know, the darn stuff now is that everything's on the internet, and I don't know if many people read books anymore, but I'd like to encourage you to get my book. I've got four of them out there. I've got six, two on the history of Clemson athletics, but four on the others. And I've always been encouraged by people to continue to write, but it is so doggone hard. It's unbelievable. It is unbelievable. But that's what that was all about. And I'm sort of ad-libbing as I've waited for our guest to get on here, and he is on here. And I wanted to... Coach, Dr. Bryce Young, are you there?
I am here for you, Coach Creasy. How are you?
Oh, great, man. And I'm glad we finally hooked up here. But I'm going to talk about 2 or 3 minutes about you and my impression, and then I'm going to have you go back, and you're going to give sort of your synopsis of what the heck you've been doing. But I'm going to tell a few of my favorite memories. I first met you in 1983, fall of 1983 at UCLA, I believe, and you were out there, Bethany, Kansas. You were coaching at Bethany College, and you and I are both young, hungry coaches trying to learn everything we could. And we got to be friends, and we watched, I had a young freshman named Lawson Duncan out there go through the qualifying rounds and make it to the semifinals. That's another story for another day. I could have gotten him out of the qualifying rounds, but I put him in there just so that he would grow. And, you know, Bryce is really interesting. He said, "What the heck, Coach? Why didn't you put me into the main draw? I could have gotten a wild card." I said, "Well, you're now in the first round of the tournament." I said, "Are you ready to go?" He said, "Yes, sir, I'm ready to go." I said, "If we had hot shot it out here off of a plane and got off and you're this new hot shot, I don't think you would have been ready for this tournament in this level." But anyhow, he went all the way to the semis and all the way to the finals in NCAA. And people laugh now, Bryce. Do you believe he played 86 matches that year? We had a freshman in college play 86 matches. And he was winning all the time. Now, it wasn't too hard. It wasn't too exhausting. It wasn't cruel and unusual punishment. But he played 86 matches. The great Jay Berger played 74 matches his freshman year, and that's just what we did. We got those reps. But, Bryce, you were there, and then we got to be friends. You went on to Pan American University for a couple years, and I think that I don't want to say intellectually you weren't being stimulated by coaching. You've always been stimulated by just having people around. But you knew there was more out there for you, and then you all of a sudden we're playing the University of Virginia, and Bryce Young shows up, and he's doing his PhD program at the University of Virginia. But here's the story, Bryce. I go, "Bryce, man, I don't know how old you are, but," I said, "how old are you going to be by the time you get your PhD?" And you looked at me dead in the eyes, and you go, "Chuck, how old will I be if I don't go back and get my PhD?" And I have used that line for every person I know. Recently, a 27-year-old guy, I'm trying to tell him to go back and get your education. And he said, "I'll be too old." I said, "Well, how old are you going to be?" So, Bryce, I wanted you to talk about your journey a little bit. Of course, you've been a sports psychologist now since 90, let's see, but nearly 30 years. Amazing. And things that you have been through have been incredible. So I'm going to stop right there, and I could make some very colorful stories of all the clinics we've done together, all of the camps we've done together over the years, and many, many stories. But bottom line, and this is what I'm going to leave you with before I let you talk. You have always worked for mastery first in success after, but you've always been in the pursuit of excellence. So, my friend, could you talk about your journey a little bit? Because I think people need to know that everything is good in life really is about deferred gratification. So go ahead.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Coach, I hope people can feel my heart and my smile over the radio, because the memories you're bringing up about our days together when you were coaching Clemson, from arriving from Tennessee Tech, I believe, and I'm coming from Bethany College, and I graduated and followed my coach. He said he was in his 70s. He was ready to retire, and he said, when someone from our program who cares as much as I do about it is willing to come in and coach, I'll retire. And so I followed my coach. You came into Clemson when they were the bottom. I mean, forgive me for saying this, because how great you made them, but they're almost a club program, and they went from the bottom of the Atlantic Coast Conference to dominating. I mean, you know, it was Clemson rules, you know, and that was all just incredible work ethic. Everything was deferred gratification. My wife Linda LeClaire, who is not only my soulmate and life partner, but she's also a leader in mental and energy coaching. She's already a certified hypnotherapist when we met, and University of Minnesota hired her as the first NC2A Division I energy coach. And I said, energy coach? How in the heck did you get a Big Ten job as an energy coach? And she said, because these young people, they don't know how to use their minds and their thoughts to use their energy. They're playing out of fear all the time, and I'm telling them they ought to be loving what they do. And so I teach them love energy instead of fear energy. And she ended up not only helping them they went from the bottom of their conference in the women's side to playing in the finals of the Big Ten, just like you took Clemson from the bottom of the ACC to the top, you know, and a national, you know, national status. And so all of that, you know, she's a Minnesota native. I'm a Kansas native. You're an Indiana native. There's something about a pioneer
Midwest work ethic, man.
that we grew
Go
up
ahead.
With, you know?
Midwest
yeah,
work
grew,
ethic.
Grew,
you got it.
You got it, and we grew up with that, and I mean the my parents, bless their hearts, we never had money, but we had the right, we had value, you know, we had honesty and we had work ethic, and we knew we were loved even when we were scrambling to get meals, you know. I remember one year my mom said we each had a new pair of jeans. Remember when you get a new pair of jeans at the start of the school year? My brother and I each got a pair of jeans that had to last the whole year. And bless her heart, Mom said, "No, nobody's going to notice they're the same jeans." And I said, "Mom, they notice."
Well, you know, there's a saying about that. It said, "We used to wear jeans because kids were poor. Now people are poor because kids wear jeans." Because the kids put these holes in them automatically. It's like... oh my gosh! But I'm same here, same stuff. Mama used to iron on our soles on tennis shoes. She could go down to the hardware, and I think for 20 cents they could get these soles that you would iron them on, and she could keep those tennis shoes going a little bit longer.
Right,
and they were iron on soles. But anyhow.
No, it's a lovely story, and there's a point to all this, and I remind most of our – there are a lot – if you look at the pyramid of tennis, the people we're watching at the Australian Open right now, it's the very, very tip of the iceberg. And yes, Linda and I have been blessed to work with players at all four Grand Slams. A friend of yours, Craig Tiley, who's, you know, the tennis director of Tennis Australia, brought us over to speak there. And we've worked – while we're there, you make your time count. I mean, you know, Australia is not easy to get to. And so we had a player over there who'd worked with us who had come here to work with us on Hilton Head, and he's playing the Australian Open. Well, long story short, those don't become, you know, everybody kind of hangs their hat on, like, the fame game, as I call it. You know, somebody's famous, well, that's, you know, fame is fleeting. But where we really do our best work is with young juniors, middle school, junior high school, their parents who are, you know, they're thrown into the USTA circuit of never having a holiday at home, because every holiday you got to be on the road playing a nationals. And so most of our clients are private clients that we're doing by phone if they can't come to Hilton Head Island and train with us in person. Eventually they end up coming here, but I mean, most of the time we're on the phone or we're on WhatsApp internationally. We're doing FaceTime. We're doing, you know, Skype, whatever it takes to help them. And everything is helping them with what your point is. How do you gain discipline? How do you gain resilience, which tennis has the ability to teach? I mean, it's one of the my tennis teacher, I had a second father, Kirk Meacham, who retired in the tiny Swedish village of Lindsborg, Kansas. It was named for the Linds family and the Borg families, like Bjorn Borg, because those are the two largest families from Sweden that moved there, the pioneers. Okay, he retires there. He sees a bunch of us kids stumbling around trying to play tennis when we weren't playing football, basketball, track, baseball. That was another sport. Tennis probably would have been fifth in those days. I mean, if you were male, you played football, you know, and everything else. So he watches us stumbling around. The man was a master teacher, a master psychologist. He comes over to my brother and me, and he says, if you'll do exactly what I ask of you, I'll give you free tennis lessons. Well, Coach, he was like an angel from heaven. We couldn't have afforded a tennis lesson anywhere, you know. And we did it. The first day, he had 40 kids in Lindsborg come to the high school courts. It was hotter than Hades. And everybody, after one day, day two, there were four of us. There were the Everhart brothers, Scott and Shannon. Scott played with me at Bethany College. Mike and Shannon won state titles and then went to Bethany. My brother turned down a full ride to KU to go to Bethany to play. I mean, tennis tradition runs deep, you know. It runs deep. Yeah. But the point with him was he was doing things the right way, work ethic, showing us grips, showing us strokes, but we had to do the rest. And so day one, there are 40 kids. Day two, there are four kids. And he literally changed our life. But Coach, he changed our lives. I mean, my whole life has been in tennis because of that. And I've got to go ahead.
No, I you're barking up the tree. I want to talk about in a minute. I want to get you finish a little bit about your story. But I want to come back to the fear factor in kids today. But the big thing also, tennis used to survive and thrive, and it was awesome in the United States because we had those people in every community that would give them themselves and give time. And then the marketeers jumped in and took over. People thought they could make a buck, and it's all now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I preach work for mastery, not success. And right now, people are going after success to an excess. But anyhow, I want to come back to that. But go ahead, finish your story here about your journey then. Bryce, it's really interesting about why did you get into sports psychology? But finish your story about that, and then I'd love to hear about your getting into sports psychology and why.
I'll nail it quick. my partner Linda LeClaire says every year of experience you get, your stories get longer. Get to the point, man.
So, well, you are. But, I mean, it's well made. I mean, meat and potatoes. You know, chop wood, carry water. About the best book out there these days. and it's easy to read, but hey, we chopped wood and carried water. That was simple.
You bet. Well, here's a quote I have for your listeners, and this goes for athletes, it goes for their parents, it goes for coaches. To the world, you may be one person, but to one person, you may be the world. And those of us who have committed our lives to teaching and coaching, not fame, not money, not all the trimmings, I think we are the most fulfilled people. We feel the most blessed. I'm thankful every day that the Creator gives me the opportunity to help people fulfill their dreams. And so, when you know, we all know, you and I know, Coach, that when you and I and Linda LeClaire are helping people fulfill their dreams, we're fulfilling our dreams. It works that way. You know, whatever you send out comes back. If you're giving, you're receiving. And you've told me that.
It's the only thing that makes any sense.
Yeah,
after a certain age, I said after 60, if you're not trying to pour out and give everything back as you get in, that's so trite to say I'm giving it back. No, you got to pour out everything you've got, probably financially too, before the good Lord takes you, or it's really sad what it looks like. It looks like a burnout rock star looking for a new gig. You know, and it's really sad when people get real old and they're looking for the same thing that used to thrill them at one time when they were trying to look for self-satisfaction. They were looking for some fame, some lame fame, you know.
Right.
So anyhow.
Well, okay, if you want to know what led me here. Yeah, I can tell you what led me here. So my second father, Kirk Meacham, also was a wonderful amateur psychologist. And I was learning as he taught me basic strokes and fundamentals and all that, he once said, you're the most conscientious student I've ever had. He said one year he and his wife left for Vienna, Austria for the winter. And before he left, he showed me a continental volley grip and he built a wall for me. Not for me, but for the town. Built a little wall over at the high school, and he brought me over with a tennis ball, and he showed me the continental grip. He showed me a basic volley, and he said, by the time I get back from Austria, you should have a good forehand and backhand volley. You should be consistent enough to hit an approach volley. You should be able to close the net, and you should be able to finish the point. And that was it. I mean, that was it, and he was gone for 3 months, and that's all I did. That's all I did, and in the winter, I went over to the swimming pool and shoveled snow around the wall of the swimming pool and hit volleys on the swimming pool wall. Well, the great thing about walls, for one thing, was the wall always sent it back, so there wasn't any, you know, problem there. The problem with me was if I missed the volley, it went onto the roof of the pool or in the pool, and I didn't have my tennis ball. So you got pretty conscientious about making the volley, and you didn't miss a lot of them in matches because, you and I didn't have a lot of money for tennis balls.
Amen. So,
So it leads me to the sports psych part. All the time I coach junior – I started a junior high program at a Hispanic American mining town. They put a net up over the teacher's parking lot, and the minute the teachers left, we started tennis. I coached high school tennis, girls and boys. Everywhere I coached that we started a girls or women's program, they still have it. So this is pre-Title IX. So everywhere I went, the other thing we did was I was a late bloomer. you when I met you, I once told you something about I was working on my game, and you said, well, you hit a plateau, but unfortunately you stayed there.
Well, we all did because that was the age we were at. Our plateau got off at a certain place, all of us, you know.
So anyway, but everywhere I went, I did no-cut tennis. And so even D1 at Pan Am, we had enough courts down there, and so I let – anybody that wanted to come out could come out if they'd do the stuff. Well, we ended up spending more time on the track than the track team. And I'm being sincere. I'm not making that up. Our track coach used to stand with a cigarette and watch the players run. And I thought, well, there's some good role modeling, you know. And so we'd go out and do our intervals on the track because they weren't using the track as much as we were. And it was all about you put in the work, you develop some resilience because you got to come out there and play every day. And if people were willing to stay out, I kept them out, you know. We had some success there. We got Coach, I remember you told me, you said, man, I'll tell you, Pan American is way, we're on a latitude with Miami. We were as far down to the tip of Texas as you can get. And in fact, I used to take teams to Mexico for matches even. That's how close we were. So long story short, one year we got Notre Dame to come play us because they were on a spring trip. I'll tell you,
wow.
We had the calendar circled for that match. I mean, it was the biggest deal to ever happen in South Texas. And we edged them. In those days, you played it out 6-3, 6 singles, 3 doubles. We edged them for the match, pulled it out, and won the last doubles to win the match. If you look in the history of Pan American tennis, we're 1-0 with Notre Dame because I don't believe we'll be playing them again.
Yeah, they might nowadays have dropped that program too. But you had great success there. But then Bethany and there, and you've always, your kids have always been motivated. But why, tell her about why did you decide to go work on your PhD? And I used
okay.
to razz you because I used to say, my golly, but basically jealousy is a tribute that mediocrity pays to greatness. I was jealous because I had planned to work on my PhD. I still have 28 hours behind me, but it never got done. Mm-hmm. But you got yours done. So talk about that a second.
Okay, very quickly. What led to it was I had always studied coaches who I thought, I mean, you are a great amateur psychologist. You've got this world of experience. Some of our colleagues who you and I respect in coaching, many of them like you are Hall of Fame coaches. Of course, you had to know something about the mental game. I just tell young people and their parents, I'm a mental coach. Don't say I have a doctorate in sports psychology. I'm a mental coach, but I've got 30 years of doing this. I go to bed at night with yellow pads around me with the names
yep.
of the people working with me saying, how can I help so-and-so? How can I get them ready for this match? How can we debrief this nationals, winter nationals, so they get the most out of it? Well, by the end of the season, everybody was fit, coach. Everybody had basic fundamental coaching because in those days it wasn't just the recruiting game where coaches were master recruiters who wanted a finished product, and then they're in the office recruiting the next group, you know. It was about actually helping players develop and improve while they were in college. And so by the end of the year, when everybody was fit and everybody had fundamentals, it was basically a wash. But I watched the teams like yours and others who had coaches who worked on both the heart, the mind, and the body, and they did better in their conference. At the end of the year when it was crunch time or when it was NC2A time, their teams and their players competed better. And I said, I want to learn everything I can, flew to New York City for the U.S. Open Tennis Teachers Conference. You and I have both spoken in it. And met the University of Virginia faculty, got back to Pan Am, had a letter on my desk, had ridden the subway to the U.S. Open with Bob Rotella, Linda Bunker, the heads of the program. There's
right.
a note saying, we're taking 2 doctoral candidates next year. We encourage you to apply. Well, the window's open. I'm able to get my assistant coach the head job at Pan Am, so I didn't feel like I was abandoning my team. He had great success there, and off I went for 4 years, 5 summers. So that was it. But, again, the deferred gratification, I knew I wanted to do this. I had to work my way through Virginia because, you know about college loans and all that debt.
Sure.
So I was Terry Hollins and Debbie Ryan's academic advisor for men's and women's basketball. So 8 to 3:30, I'd go to class. 3:30 to 6:30, we'd work with the teams as just interns, volunteers, get experience. 6:30 to 10:30, I was in study hall with the Virginia UVA men's and women's basketball. And then 10:30 to about 3 or 4 in the morning, I'd do my work. And I did that for 4 years and 5 summers and came out the other end with a doctorate. But that it really was about, you know, it's your head and your heart to go with trusting your training. And you know, I could do as much or as little as you want on this, but there's a training mindset and there's a trusting mindset, Coach. The training mindset, you can be self-critical. You're giving your players information. You want to see them act on it. You got to develop habits. I mean, at the end of the day, even the great philosophers say our life is just a collection of all our habits. If you really think about how most people go through their day, from brushing their teeth in the morning to tying their shoes, things you don't think about, it's based on your habits. Well, if your habits are really good and deep, you have less to think about when the lights are brightest and you're playing at the Australian Open, you're playing for Citadel, you're playing for Clemson, you're playing for Bethany College. That's what I do now is I honor the coach who's with their athlete every day. I don't try to change any of that. I try to help them use it better. Whatever the coach has given them, I try to help them use it better. And that means trusting your training. So we do things in that area. But I got to put in a quick thing about Bethany. One of the joys of life is our tennis courts there were 50 years old. They had totally deteriorated, the ones that I had played on, and they were unplayable. They couldn't play on them. And it's a little town of about 3,000. The college is about 1,000. And they had no tennis courts. So I was able to get together with Bethany tennis family, the alumni. We raised enough money the last 6 years to build them a brand new tennis center. I got to fly out for a dedication.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. So they've got 6 brand new courts. The high school has a 40-year coach, Coach Ron Dahlstein, and his successor, John Bella. They've earned 30 state tennis titles. They've got 8 new courts at the Ron Dahlstein Tennis Complex. They now have these wonderful 14 new courts in a town of 3,000 with a college of 1,000. And it's going to it'll touch lives for generations, you know?
Right. That's right. Bryce, real quick here. Do you need to go to we'll go to commercial to regroup? Let me tell you what I want to go here now in the second half of our program.
Okay.
I want to talk a little bit about tennis versus other sports, and because you've worked with basketball and all kinds of athletes, I want to get to the kids are not afraid of failing these days. They're afraid of success. Recently, I told my athletic director, most young people do not want to really succeed to a high level. They just don't want to be bad at what they do. And we have a disease of mediocrity there. You know, I want to talk about those challenges of working with young people. I want to talk about the marketeers a little bit. And I want to give parents a good approach when they're looking at their youngsters. And if you will hang tight, let me go do this commercial again here. And I will be right back in about a minute or so. And it's Chuck Creasy, and I'd like to say, just like Coach Bryce Young has mentioned about tennis being multidimensional, it's much, much more than just how you hit the ball. The psychology of it is immense, the mental part, the mental training, and then also it's much deeper than that, the emotional balances that you have to find when you compete. I've got all of these covered in my book, Coaching Tennis, and it's in many countries around the world now, and we have over 40,000 copies out there. And I wanted to encourage you to go to Amazon and order Coaching Tennis. And stay tuned for more of Dr. Bryce Young. Making them in America, and we need to continue making them in America. And Dr. Young, I always brag that I get very irritated, and I don't want to go off topic here, but I get very irritated that we copy anybody else in the world. I don't care if it's the Spanish system, the Swedish system, the Timbuktu system. The United States of America is the greatest country in the world. We have the best resources. We have the best coaches. We have the best opportunities with American colleges, and we are not maximizing our potential with young people. We have not had a male champion since 2001 or 2002 with Andy Roddick. That's 72 tries in Grand Slams, four per year times 16 years or whatever it is. Looks like Tennis Sangren to me might be the guy. It might be the guy on the man's side that is really doing the work, staying the course, carrying wood and chopping wood and carrying water and doing all the dirty work stuff. And I just wanted to give a little side note here. Yesterday, all the players are watching, Dr. Young, they're watching the Australian Open, and they came out and they said, "You see Federer down four match points, Tennis Sangren, oh my gosh, oh my gosh." Well, first of all, I said, you know, you don't get to save match points when you're playing that silly no-add scoring. You know, you just – it's over, it's over.
Right.
You know, it's sort of
right, –
you know,
right.
The drama has been taken out. Bryce, they always say to me, they say, "Oh, it's the excitement in no-add." I said, excitement dwindles with each occurrence. Drama intensifies with each denial. You know, it's sort of like watching a slasher movie versus an Alfred Hitchcock. There's not even close. It's not even close to the drama, you know, drama. So anyhow, Dr. Young, we are hurting right now in the United States of America. I would like for you to talk about what is going on. Why are we not maximizing our potential in the good old USA? Where is it falling through the cracks?
Wow, what you're asking the million-dollar question, because we have all of the resources to be producing the top athletes and the top coaches. I mean, we have everything we need. We're lacking some. Let me state something I still remember that your mom taught you, okay? And you correct me if I'm wrong, because it's your mother's statement.
Okay.
She we were talking about wisdom, and you said, my mother once said, wisdom is knowledge plus truth. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
She added the spiritual part of it, truth of the Holy Spirit, or truth of living for a long enough time to understand the discernment. She used to talk about discernment. She said, son, don't take any wood nickels. Don't get led astray. She used to talk about have discernment to be able to see underneath the thing. So go ahead.
Right. And to answer your question is, we have tons of externals. We have tons of material resources that make life easy, comfortable, very comfortable. We have tons of information flooding young athletes. We lack wisdom, as your mom defined it, and we lack valuing experience, for example, valuing, you know, I mean, my parents taught me to really respect people with more experience than I had, which was everybody, you know, as I was growing up. And I think we look for instant answers a lot. And so part of it is, I think we have to help develop resilience in our athletes. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean we have to beat people up, but the athletes do have to learn the ups and downs and certainly deferred gratification. I mean, definitely tennis is a deferred gratification sport. It's not one of the sports that you go out and learn it in 15 minutes and you get success. And
right.
And so you really have to stay with it. I was speaking out at Linda LeClaire and I are going to be speaking at the PTR, where I've introduced you, the Professional Tennis Registry International Symposium, in February. But I was out at USPTA one time in La Quinta with Bill Bond, who played for Southern Cal. And we were talking between sessions, and he said, I really feel that the athlete who wants to be a tennis player needs a coach for about 7 years who he goes back to. He doesn't do the flavor of the month. He doesn't take the new guy in town and jump over to him when times are tough, or on the pro tour, somebody loses a tiebreak, so they fire the coach, you know?
I call him Miyagi. I call him, everybody needs a Miyagi from the Karate
okay.
Kid.
Yep. And he said, because that person knows you inside and out. They know your heart, your mind, your soul. They know your game, and they've got most coaches with experience develop a pretty good eye, and they're not going to overdo things. I mean, I've had pros on the ATP tour and the WTA say, Doc, it was what you told me was a little thing, but when I played, it was a big thing. It's like knowing them well enough to know what to say, but you don't have to overstate it. It's just like, I'll give you an example. Harvey Penick. I talked to Ben Crenshaw one night. We talked about multiple sports, and then you can lead me back in here. But I had dinner with Ben Crenshaw one night, and all we did was talk. I talked about Mr. Kirk Meacham, my teacher. He talked about Harvey Penick, his golf teacher. And he said, Mr. Penick had the most marvelous eye, the most gentle way of teaching. He said, people talked about gripping the golf club, and he said, you know, words are powerful. He said, grip to me means like you're tight and tense. I just say, why don't you just place your hands like this on the golf club? Well, think about it. Place your hands or grip the golf club.
Yep.
Which one has more touch to it? Right. So basically, what you're looking for, I think, are athletes who will commit to a teacher and a coach. And you and I probably didn't have a lot of choice because we didn't come from silver spoon backgrounds with tons of money, so we couldn't change pros all the time. We were lucky to get a lesson. We were basically athletes at our stage who wanted to be tennis players. And that's the same way I was when we met. I was a young coach. I would go anywhere, anytime to learn from a coach. Russell Seymour came to the town next to Bethany College to do a clinic. I volunteered to be his assistant, his gopher, on the whole day of his clinic, so he'd come talk to my college team on Sunday after church for an hour. That was the trade-off. Because Russell Seymour was a South African who knew a lot. Bobby McKinley, one of yours and my friends, I asked Bobby McKinley when I met him at the ITA, and this you weren't around. I said, I'm a young coach. I want to learn everything I possibly can from the coaches who you respect. He said, well, you ought to talk to Coach Creasy because he's building a program the right way down at Clemson. Then after I got my doctorate, Bobby flew me into San Antonio to work with his players. But I mean, basically, there's so much out there that we have in the U.S. in the way of great coaches and people who can be, but we can't get stuck in the bureaucracy. You know, we got to go where the best coaches are.
So I want to jump in there and build on that point that you said we have so much. And I often refer to 1980 sitting in the National Teachers Conference at the Roosevelt Hotel, listen to the great Clarence Mabry, who was Bobby McKinley's coach in the Trinity University for years, Bryce. And someone, of course, I'm a young coach, hanging on to every word he said. He's the best. He was the one that was full of wisdom, not just a flash in the pan. And someone asked the question, what is Coach Mabry, what is the most important stroke or quality, what's the most important thing for a championship tennis player? He sort of scratched his chin and he said, most definitely the most important quality is the hunger of an inquisitive mind, one that asks questions, what's next, how do I do this? He said, and I hung on that forever because everyone was flabbergasted. They were thinking, oh, big ripping forehand, a bigger serve, learning how. And so the point is, now, Bryce, we have the inquisitive minds are being stifled because of the computers and because of the cell phones. I gave one of my players, holy heck, riding in the car recently. I asked him to change the clock on the car clock, and he didn't know how to do it. Instead, he said, let me look it up. I said, no, you're not going to look it up. You're not going to look that up. Figure it out. I said, figure it out, son. Don't tell me you're going to look up something. And here I said, if a young college kid, you know, they have answers right before them all the time. So learning has to change. It has to go from all this information that is meaningless until the kids lock in. One time that a youngster locks in and asks those questions and figures it out on himself, we all know as coaches that's 100 times for a coach telling him to do the same thing. But now let me make this point too, as I can jump in. Tennis Sangren, I was talking about him, and I think he'll be our next champion. And here's the reason why. He went to the University of Tennessee. I remember watching him overseas. I think it was Austria. It was Belgium. Right before the French Open in the juniors. And I think his mother was over there, and he was with his brother and his scrappy kids. And I said, oh, he's going to go to University of Tennessee. That's good. So he goes to the University of Tennessee. And then, of course, he struggles in the futures and the challengers. Gosh, what was it? 6 years, 5 or 6 years. So the other day, my players are going, my gosh, Federer was down 4 match points to Tennis Sangren. I said, oh, Tennis Sangren, wow, he must have had some fairy dust or something on him, because wow, he was in all futures, all that. Wait a minute, they sprinkled the fairy dust or the magic potion on him, and wow, he's now almost beating Federer. I said, was it that, or was it the inch by inch by inch by inch and all of the reps that he got over and over and over from winning, but mainly from losing and having the inquisitive mind to try to figure out what's next, how do I get better, what's the next thing I do? So I'm going to leave you with that to ask you about talk about the challenges we have. What are the challenges we have then with young people that you see? You work with them all the time. It's fear, but is it fear of success more than it is of failure? Like I was pointing out, I don't think they're afraid of failure because they all get participation trophies, Bryce. I think they're afraid of being good because then they have responsibilities to live up to something. What are your thoughts?
You certainly have a point. I deal with both. I deal with the fear of failure piece comes that you just really encapsulated the fear of success part of it. The fear of failure is most of the junior players who are working with us, and when I finish I'll give you our website, because anybody can go on and I would welcome anybody texting me.
Well, give it now and give it many times. Give it now so people remember. What's your website?
You just go to yourmentalcoach.com. That's all you have to do.
Okay.
And yourmentalcoach.com. And I'll even give you my private number. If somebody wants to text me, that's the easiest way to get through to me. Just go to 612-269-4949. You just text me at 612-269-4949 if you have a question or you would like to get in touch, you know, regarding working with a young athlete or a coach. I'm happy to respond. But here's where most of the juniors are. Their grail is they would love to find a college program to play in, and we'll need to do another program on how we make that possible for young American players. And they're afraid that by putting themselves out and competing, that every college coach is studying their universal tennis rating, and if they lose a match or they lose a practice match at home to some other young person in their academy or across town, that they'll never get to play college tennis, and so their dream will die. And so there's some fear of success with the responsibility piece. There's some fear of failure with, if I compete, there's a chance I'll lose. If I lose, I'll never get to play anywhere after this. I'm done. There's a lot of playing out of fear. There's not a lot of this is just a step. You know, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And we have to help parents and young people understand that's how you build resilience.
Well, that's exactly right. Now, there's always fear of messing up somehow, I guess. But my thought was that here's my problem. I don't see kids pushing the edge of the envelopes pursuing excellence. I feel like everything around us now, from the top-down management, it's becoming a socialist organization, and our country is more there, where we reward the slackers a lot by bringing them into the pot, but we're always lassoing the high achievers and bringing them back into the pot as well. And the point being is that whether it is there's a saying that when you champion the weak, you weaken our real champions. Bryce, even at the National Spelling Bee, they named like 8 champions because they said they couldn't sit them down. You know, they got the last 8 words right or something like that. Well, that's ludicrous. And we sometimes are naming 6 or 7 valedictorian champions. And that's bad enough, but the participation trophy, so everybody's getting something in some way, either for being sort of average or greatly average or sort of good. So my thing is, I know for a fact that I participated for fear of failure because we had the Vietnam War going on. You remember? We had to do pretty well.
Sure.
Life was not going to be good if we didn't get to go to college, correct? But and I'm not saying the kids don't have some fear of failure, but we have a log jam in this country that I don't know if it will be broken or not, because it's just a epidemic of mediocrity, of tweener. I call it tweenerism.
Mm-hmm. You've got my synapses firing here. You've got my neurotransmitters going off in my brain. a very good friend of mine, Gary Shear. He and I taught and coached together. He became the Lieutenant Governor of Kansas and a phenomenal person. He started a group called Leadership Kansas, which is spread all over the country, in which you had to apply for it to be one of 35 people who would then come back and provide leadership for your state, being a servant leader. He has a quote I love. He said, "Bryce, good is the enemy of better." Now, that falls in line with what you're saying. In other words, good enough, okay? Good enough. That
yes.
you participated, or everybody won. And so, you know, when I thought about it, I think you're right. When I work with any group and they say, well, that's good enough, you know they're going to become mediocre.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I wanted to play something. We've got time here. I wanted to play an excerpt from Whiplash. Did you see the movie Whiplash? Whiplash is
what?
A parrot.
I'm to be honest with you, Coach, I'm reading a lot and writing a lot, but I'm not seeing very many movies.
Okay. Do you have time? It's about 3 minutes, and then we've got about four
yep.
or 5 minutes left. Do you have that time? I don't want to take – you have that time?
It's whatever you want to do.
Okay. This is a parody, and folks out there, listen. Whiplash is a parody on the pursuit of excellence versus mediocrity. So it's a young drummer up at like the Juilliard School, but they call it, I forget what they call it, the Schaefer Music Academy or something. Well, this young, he falls under the tutelage of probably the meanest, toughest coach ever. And the coach just mocks and beats and scares everybody to death to the place where he tries to looking for excellence. But here is the excerpt, and I'd like for you to listen to it. It's 3 minutes long, and then tell me what you think.
I'm sorry. No, listen.
Nah, I'm sorry.
I get it. I know I made enemies. I'm conducting a little well. They brought back the JVC Fest this year. They got me opening in a couple of weeks with a pro band.
That's great.
Yeah, it's all right. Truth is, I don't think people understood what it was I was doing at Schaefer. I wasn't there to conduct. Any fucking moron can wave his arms and keep people in tempo. I was there to push people beyond what's expected of them. I believe that is an absolute necessity. Otherwise, we're depriving the world of the next Louis Armstrong, the next Charlie Parker. I told you that story about how Charlie Parker became Charlie Parker, right?
Joe Jones threw a cymbal at his head.
Exactly. Parker's a young kid, pretty good on the sax. Gets up to play at a cutting session. Then he fucks it up. And Jones nearly decapitates him for it. And he's laughed off stage. Cries himself to sleep that night, but the next morning, what does he do? He practices. And he practices and he practices with one goal in mind, never to be laughed at again. And a year later, he goes back to the Reno, and he steps up on that stage and he plays the best motherfucking solo the world has ever heard. So imagine if Jones had just said, well, that's okay, Charlie, that was all right. Good job. Then Charlie thinks to himself, well, shit, I did do a pretty good job. End of story. No bird. That, to me, is an absolute tragedy. But that's just what the world wants now. People wonder why jazz is dying. But amen. Every Starbucks jazz album just proves my point, really. There are no two words in the English language more harmful than good job.
But is there a line? You know, maybe you go too far and you discourage the next Charlie Parker from ever becoming Charlie Parker?
No, man, no. Because the next Charlie Parker would never be discouraged.
Yeah.
The truth is, Andrew, I...
So, Dr. Young, that's a movie that you really, really need to watch because it's very controversial. It was up about 6 or 7 years ago. I watched it 5 times. All you parents out there, do not watch it with your children. Language is terrible, and you're just going to hate this guy for a while. But all I can tell you is at the end of the movie, the kid gets it. He becomes a great instead of an average. He really pushed the edge of the envelope with this kid. To an excess. But anyhow, your comments, and then we've got to end here in a minute.
Okay, very quickly, I teach through stories, and when I do sessions on the phone, I tell people it's going to feel like a conversation, but we'll make sure you get the points. And we shared an athlete. I had a young man, real quickly, John Witter, who's now at Lifetime Fitness in Tempe, Arizona. Okay, he has sent his son, Andrew, now full circle to play for Bethany College in Lindsberg, Kansas. So Andrew's there now. Well, very quickly, when John was with us before he played for you at Clemson, he and David Peace played at Clemson for a year. We went to see Bjorn Borg and Billy Martin play a fundraiser in Topeka, Kansas. I'm in the locker room. Borg is changing clothes to go on court. I said, it would mean the world to a Swedish team, Bethany Swedes, to have their picture taken with you, Bjorn. He said, I've got to hit with a bunch of rich people for a minute because it was a fundraiser, but I'll get my photo with you. Billy Martin goes out to play with him, and Borg wasn't feeling well. Well, Billy wants to win the match. He's won the NC2A. Billy wins a set. He's leading in the second, and he hits a ball, a passing shot on Borg, and he says, come on, and right in Borg's face, Borg turned his back, shifted a gear, the match was over. I mean, it was like, it was an exhibition. It was an exhibition until the come on.
It was the exhibition of you don't poke a, I always tell people you don't poke a sleeping bear, or you don't rub someone's face in dirty laundry, basically, or anything. You don't do that.
No,
I always tell my guys,
no,
it'll backfire on you if you do that stuff.
But anyway, so my very best greetings from John to you, and he has total respect for what you build at Clemson and you're building at Citadel, and I'm so thankful that we're able to build a program at Bethany again with their new tennis center. And what was I never had a scholarship in 10 years, Coach. We won 10 conference titles with no scholarships. Now they have full tuition scholarships for tennis. So you know, it's a little different paradigm, but as long as you can get good kids who have work ethic, who are willing to work just as hard after they lose a tiebreak in the third, on the next practice, we're going to build that resilience you and I are looking for. And who knows, maybe miracles still happen. Maybe we can rebuild American tennis just like we're building, you know, Bethany and Citadel tennis.
Well, that's what our program's about, and that's why I keep it rolling. And I hope that you will come back on the show again. I'm putting up on the wall today, to the world you may be one person, but to one person you may be the whole world. So anyhow, Bryce Young, thank you, and God bless you. And I'm going to call you later, and I want you back on. Thank you, Bryce Young.
God bless you, Coach.
Made in America, born in a hot land, raised up a family, a King James and Uncle Sam. He's got the red, white, blue, flying high on a farm. Semper Fi. Come.
Coach Chuck Creasy reminding you you're in the process of winning or losing every day of your life, and it has very little to do with a win or a loss. See y'all next week.